The universe was opening at the seams as far as they were concerned. But the next day wasn't even worth the trip over here. And this is life. If we can just get ourselves past this first flare-up of tremendous intensities, we will frequently take over the situation ourselves and handle it. But if in that flare-up we do something or say something that has permanently detrimental effects, then we may be half a lifetime getting over it. We may be angry with the man with whom we have been dealing in business, and we may wish him all kinds of trouble. But if we pause and go off and reflect about it a little bit, we may work it out. But if in the heat of our difficulty, in that moment of supreme anger, we pick up a rock and break his store window, then we're in trouble. We just didn't pause. And that would have been the pause that would have refreshed us. But we didn't use it. So we got into trouble. And in the moments of emergency, it isn't always the thing itself, the emergency, that gets us into trouble. It is what we do about it in the heat of an emotional pressure. It is not the magnitude of the original event. It's what we have done to bruise, injure, and enlarge that event that perhaps becomes the big problem we later have to handle. So wise persons have begun to recognize the importance in psychology of gradually gaining a certain calmness, a certain ability to meet even serious situations with some personal integration. I knew a person who did pretty well at that. Tragedy struck their family, and a very near and loved one passed on. This person stood up through the funeral beautifully. So beautifully that the relatives thought that they didn't care for the deceased and had absolutely no human sympathy. Everyone else was weeping copiously. And self-control was regarded in this case as a fault by people who'd never had it. Actually, the person who didn't do the weeping was the one who paid all the bills for the sick person. The others did the weeping, but nothing else. This situation recurs continuously. And we do sometimes have to stand a certain amount of criticism if we integrate. People expect other people to fall apart. If they don't, it's an insult. We resent the composure of those persons who are able to handle situations better than we are. But this is one kind of resentment we will have to get over. It is not any good for the other person to compromise his own principles and try to please everyone. One way that the ancients had of approaching this problem was to quietly sit down by a retrospectional exercise, and through a process of meditation or contemplation, to put the laws of nature into the incidents of life. If at the end of a day we can take 5 minutes to try to find out what the day meant, or if we can occasionally tear ourselves away from the television long enough to sit down and say, what did I learn from this thing that I've just gone through? What did it really mean? And try to get underneath this grand blanket explanation that you may have arrived at, namely that you were simply being made to suffer unjustly, and try to find out what it all added up to. Why did the things happen? How did you fail? How did you contribute to an unhappy situation that you have just passed through? And how are you going to make something good out of the consequences? There is no book in the world in which we can learn more than the book of our own lives. We all have mysteries of things that have happened. Good luck, bad luck, strange and involved circumstances. We've never really straightened them out. They've never become the source of new courage or strength to us. If we would sit down and think them through, perhaps they would. We could gradually learn what these things have meant and how they prove the operation of universal law. If we look back over a long lifetime of unadjusted activity, we can at least get a picture of what unadjustment does to us. We cannot look back over a poorly lived life and then contemplate the result as favorable. It cannot be. There may be some things we did fairly well, and for these we have had some rewards. And this is also important, because it points out although the law is a general law, its operation is as specific as every incident in our own lives. We may have been unpleasant to everyone we know. This is in the law, and it sits there as a record. But we were good to a cat, and that is also in the law. There is a record of it. We were on the wrong side of every question, perhaps, except one. But that one, on which we were on the right side, has also produced its own unique result. Consequently, we are not simply hit over the head with a club in a collective punishment for everything that we do. The life of the individual is a mixture of things done in varying degrees of rightness and wrongness. The consequences are therefore also a mixture. The reason that every day we live is a mass of confusion is because it does represent the total of the confusion which created it. So if today isn't quite the kind of a day you most enjoy, then it is due to the mixture of the various factors of psychological activity which have come down in their varying degrees of development to now. And here they are as the sum total of their own past, presenting themselves as strength or weakness in our immediate activity. If we will study a little while these various factors in ourselves, we can see the operation of the law. And if we go through a long experience study of this nature and come out without the discovery of law, we have just been kidding ourselves. Now, one thing that's hard for most people is to be that honest. They don't mean to be dishonest, but it's just very difficult for the average person to intelligently estimate his own mistakes. He will either deny them utterly and insist that the world was against him, or else he will take on the attitude of a penitent, consider that he is a worm, worse than nothing, and that he doesn't deserve anything better than cosmic flagellation till the end of time. Again, a creature of excesses. He simply cannot sit down and weigh and estimate himself as he might a stranger or another person. He cannot say, in this I was just about right, and in that one I was certainly wrong. He can't do this quietly. Every time he was right, he kind of gets egotistic over the thought of it. And every time he was wrong, he either tries to talk himself out of it or goes into a deep despond over the whole thing. He simply cannot think these things through straight. He has to mix them, confuse them, emotionalize them. And as a result, justice evaporates. The facts are not observable or notable to him. So it's a hard problem. It takes a little discipline to get this thing started right. But it can be done, and it will pay off very heavily in improvement of life and conduct. Let's put it in another way, because this might help to clarify things. If you think that you've had a run of bad luck, that just problems seem to be getting bigger and bigger, that things just seem to be going less and less as they should, this sort of suggests a little self-examination. Are you developing some unusual psychophysical symptoms? Are you subject to strange ailments that defy scientific analysis? One of the most common things we hear from people who come for help is, I've been to the best doctors who say there isn't a thing of matter with me and I'm absolutely miserable. There's no physical thing that could be found. Now, this doesn't mean there wasn't anything physical, because even the best physicians don't always find them. And no two of them will agree entirely on what they do find. But there are many instances in which the person is physically in good health, as far as any scientific knowledge will permit us to know. Yet this person is a wreck. They're falling apart. They're too tired to put one foot in front of the other. They are suffering from all kinds of symptoms. They are under the pressure of everything from migraines to arthritis. And yet there's nothing wrong with them. They're just miserable. Or as they used to say in the old days, before they had scientific names for everything, they were just ailing. This type of situation certainly suggests a psychological pressure of some nature. And it's nearly always there if you start looking for it. The individual whose psychological life is bad is uncomfortable. His probabilities of success in anything are greatly diminished. His probabilities of being able to live a fairly optimistic personal life are very few and very poor. He's just allowing his temperament to completely wreck him and opening him through this constant debilitation to all kinds of physical ailments that may ultimately set in and destroy him. He just is not fair to his own life. And yet you can't tell him. He is set in his peculiar viewpoints. But sometimes when you can't tell a person, you may be able to interest them in discovering for themselves. Anything you give to another person is advice, and most folks resent it. But if we can give the person some instruments by means of which he can analyze himself and come to discover in himself the reason for his own condition, when he sees it in himself, he can't do very much except accept it. He can no longer deny it. You can diagnose him correctly and he will hate you. But if he can diagnose himself, he has to acknowledge what he finds, because it is part of his own temperament to believe himself to be right. And if he analyzes his own nature and comes up to some positive results, he has to accept these results as indication that he has the power to think, that he is capable of being a reasonable creature. So if we can get everyone to take this attitude generally, that life is divided into two ways of doing things and two kinds of things you can do. One is right and the other is wrong. There is no middle ground in this. But the right is in the middle, for the right is always equilibrium. And the wrong is at both extremities, both excessive attitudes of exaltation or depression, of too much egotism and too little. The excesses are always the worst. But the right thing itself is that which advances the compound purpose of the individual and does so in a manner that is harmonious with law and therefore brings no retribution to the person. When we perform the action correctly, we get a reward. When we perform it incorrectly, we get a retribution. We've all had enough retributions. We don't need any more unless we have to have them. But we have not had as many rewards as we would like, and we wish we could have more of them. And the way to have more of them is to cause them. In effect and cause operating in nature, everything we want has to be caused by an attitude, a condition, or an action, or a thought, or emotion suitable to produce that thing. Causes have a certain similarity with their effects. They also are consistent in being related to the inevitable consequence which follows them. If we wish to have a peaceful life, we must cause it. And how do we cause a peaceful life? By performing all actions necessary to ensure the peace of life. We must set up the pattern. If we should inherit from some ancestor 40 acres of good farmland, we might sit back and say to ourselves, now we will have a fine crop of hay. But if we do nothing with the land, it will not long produce anything. It is the industry with which we work the 40 acres that determines whether or not there will be any hay. It is exactly the same with man. The Bible parables are very wise in these things. What we sow, we reap. If we sow the whirlwind, we reap the whirlwind. If we sow corn, we will have corn. If we sow wheat, we will have wheat. If we sow nothing, we will have weeds. There is just no escaping these principles. So whatever kind of life we want, assuming that it is a proper and right life in itself, that life we must cause. For this life of intended purpose will not cause itself. We cannot simply wait with the full assurance that in time these good things will come. For between us and this time that we think of will be a large interval of other things that are not good. If then there is any condition in life which is not agreeable, we must cause its correction or removal. If there is some good goal that we know is right, which is apparently remote, we must bring it nearer by causing it. And in each problem, we must bring the cause to its proper fruition. And having set a cause in motion, whatever it is, we must accept without grief or grievance the result of that cause we have set in motion. Man has the right to create a cause pattern. But once it is caused, he loses control of it. It becomes inevitable that it will produce some effect. Now, he may go to work on this cause soon after he starts it and attempt to modify it. And if he works hard enough, he can modify it. But he must cause the modification. If he does this, he will cause the modification of the effect. But everything has to operate according to a pattern of planned purpose. If then our life is not what we want, we have to decide what we want and cause it. If we are wise people, we will want that which is good. If we are unwise people, we will merely want some gratification of something that has been denied us. If we choose the wrong goal, we will be penalized by getting what we chose, and then finding we cannot endure it. And this has happened many, many times. Therefore, nature will teach us in this way. If our goal is unworthy of us and we attain it, it is not worth its cost. But if it is right and proper, then we can build by gradual intensification of our own determination. Now, the proper goal that people who are really thoughtful and wise should be working for is this goal of internal integration, the bringing of the nature together in peace. This is the most important thing there is, that man should be able to live with himself, that he should find in his internal life a strength, a dignity, and beauty that are greater than any stress from the outside, and that through the gradual development of this inner dignity, he will also gradually gain access to the universal principles which we call life and God and truth. Thus, the purpose of the person is to grow into a true human being. A true human being is a humane being. A being in whose nature the graces of life have found their maturity. That this person is the ideal character with which literature and art and religion and philosophy have been decorated. He is, or they, this character is the symbol of the truly good person, good in all respects and parts, and enjoying the courage and the wisdom, the understanding, and the gentleness of true greatness. This is the being that we would like to be, and we have to begin to cause it. And we cause it by doing the things that produce it. If we want to be wise, which is one of the most necessary elements, then we must cause wisdom in ourselves. If we want to be kind, we must earn the kindness in ourselves. Whatever we wish to bring to bear upon this archetypal being, the creation of which is the creation of the transcendent one in Chinese philosophy, we have to bestow upon ourselves these virtues by acquiring them and then building them into consciousness. If we are inept in everything and cannot make a decent living, then we go to a business advisor. He tells us to learn to do something well, may give us an aptitude test to find out what we can do best, and then suggest we go back to school or go to night school and a trade school or by correspondence or by some means get the training that we need. This is in order that we may be adjusted economically here. In order to be adjusted psychologically inside of ourselves, we must then find our needs and settle ourselves to gaining those attributes and powers without which we cannot function adequately. We have apparently certain endowments. We call them gifts. These gifts are the conscious attainment we bring forward from the past. Upon these gifts we must build. These constructive endowments we must expand and develop. But we have also brought with us a load of unfinished business. And this also has to be faced. Now what are we going to do then with the emergencies that arise in spite of the fact that apparently we have not immediately caused them, that these emergencies are remote things? Buddha would have called them, of course, the gradual gathering up of the loose ends of karma. And in this gathering of loose ends, we are continually confronted with circumstances that appear to be irritating, appear to be difficult, and perhaps even tragic. Nature is, however, not testing us in the ordinary sense of the word. It is simply bringing to focus causations which are real but remote, because causes and effects move in cycles of various sizes. Some causes and effects have their results in terms of minutes. A certain cause will have its effect in 2 hours, 4 hours. That thing we ate for dinner will have its effect within 3 or 4 hours. Poison will have its effect in 2 or 3 minutes. Whatever the cycle of this law may be, the effect will follow the cause, inevitably. But some of the effect cycles are much larger than the average life of the person. Therefore, he brings forward a great many larger cyclic life problems, which often result from large cyclic patterns of mistakes, such as too many people are building right now. Where a whole generation goes, for example, to the excess that this generation has gone to in worldly comforts and conveniences, and has attained these at such a complete sacrifice of moral and ethical principles. This means a generation that must face a future, and that a cycle must necessarily arise in which this attitude will be corrected, because no one will ever be allowed to get away with it. But it may not happen in this lifetime. But there are things we bring with us that did not happen in this lifetime. So we not only have the problem of creating new situations that are right, but as Pythagoras pointed out, we have the eternal problem of facing the situations that already exist or that come to face us. If we face these problems as we previously did, we will set a new cycle of causation in action. Buddha tells us this. If when the emergency arises, we become as rattled as we have always been, as unfair as we previously were, and as selfish as we may have intended to be, we will simply project this same problem again into the future, because we have brought into effect upon it a series of destructive methods which become causes of further trouble. If we meet an effect badly, then this very circumstance causes a new effect which we will have to meet again. It is therefore not only wise for us to try to do new things well, but also to try to clear up old business well. To clear up old business in a constructive manner is quite a trick. But it is quite possible to the person who has already begun to think. He may say to himself, here I am at 40, getting along pretty well, everything seemed to be going very well, and all of a sudden my business fails. Apparently through no fault of my own. And this man may have a sufficiently good business background to be pretty fair in his estimations. He may be quite honest on this subject, that he cannot see how he could have prevented this failure. Now, he has a problem on his hands now. How is he going to react to this problem? Is he simply going to take it out on his competitors? Is he simply going to accept the fact that they ruined him? This he would not want them to do to him, because he would insist that if they have a good product, as he had a good product, they have a right to succeed, and that their success should not spell his failure, especially if he lived with them for a number of years and they didn't spell failure. He may have all kinds of other attitudes to explain this problem, but actually he is faced with a crisis. This crisis is either going to force him to make more mistakes, or it is going to force him to think straight and come through this thing. He may, under certain pressure, simply go into a complete nervous breakdown. Many individuals who have passed through a serious business crisis have ended the mental hospital. They are simply unable to adjust to it. Whether it is the loss of the business or the loss of their ego is a very hard thing to tell sometimes. Perhaps in reality, it is this sudden sense of failure which a person finds it great difficulty in adjusting to. He cannot be humiliated without some kind of a terrible hurt inside of himself. He has been a leader. Now he is no longer a leader. He has been respected for his knowledge. Now he is no longer respected. These things destroy him. He becomes unable to do anything else with the situation. Even if he comes out of this problem, he's a broken man. And he will drift along in whatever way he can, half-heartedly perhaps trying to rebuild, and perhaps to a measure getting back on his feet to the degree that the immediate wounds are not opened, but actually still a pretty badly damaged person. This situation happens frequently. There are other people who faced with the same situation. A man came into me once who had had this same thing happen under a very trying and critical situation. His own children had stolen his business. Now, that's a pretty hard thing to be faced with. And I know a great many persons who would have either committed suicide or murder under that provocation, or at least had a very dignified ulcer. But this chap didn't. He simply, for some reason that was sometimes hard to explain, he simply took it in stride. Well, he says, I got rid of that business. Now, he says, I don't have to do that anymore. Now I'm going to do some of the things I want to do. So he started a new business, an entirely different field. He said, I was tired of that one anyway. And he has succeeded because he didn't pay any attention to the idea of failure. It didn't worry him. He didn't even hate his children. If he had hated his children, he would have never started another business. He would have been defeated by that alone. But he has some beliefs that are rather good, basically. He said, you know, I don't hate them. I'm not even angry with them. I was a little hurt at first. But he said, the thing that now concerns me most of all is that I'm desperately sorry for them. I know in my heart that they have set something in motion that must ultimately hurt them. He said, I'd do anything I could to try to explain that and help them to see that. But he said, I can't do it now. He said, I'm worried over what they've done to themselves, not what they've done to me. Because I can get along. He said, I don't have to live with this. They do. So he started out and succeeded again. It was just a difference in attitude. Now, these differences of attitudes indicate clearly that we can have these different attitudes. And we can often have them in one person, a whole variety of them. But when a problem comes up that has to be faced, and it is a difficult problem, the question is to regard it in some instances as a release, in some as a solution, and in some as a tremendous incentive to make great discovery, to advance some part of our own natures by a dramatic achievement of self-directive. If we do this, we do not get the negative results. We do not penalize ourselves and tear down our worlds. One of the hardest things, perhaps, is to live with people who are continually negative and who therefore work a continuing hardship upon a person who tries to retain his own optimism. But here again, we face the same problem, exactly. The negative person should not really be blamed because they are doing something to themselves that we could pray they do not do. We must give them every possible incentive to get over it, just as we would not like to see any creature destroy itself. If we saw a man raise a gun to his head, we try to take it away from him instinctively. If he jumps in the river, we'll try to jump in and save him, even though perhaps we drown with him. These are human instincts. We do not like to see people hurt themselves. And even if we're angry with them for a moment, this passes. And in the wiser person, there's always this tremendous sense of the danger that another person places himself in when he lives less than himself. But this danger can also occur to our own natures if we live less than our own understanding. So in all these problems, if we can face them, and not with the antagonisms and the resistances with which people so often react, but simply face change as perhaps the most important thing in the world. I know a case that has come to my attention recently of a very close mother-daughter relationship. The mother was exceedingly long-lived, and finally, before she did pass, the daughter herself was in her 70s. It was one of those very close ties. The daughter had never had any life of her own at all. She'd never married. She'd never had a romantic affair. She'd never had a profession. All she had done was take care of her mother. Now, you can imagine what this meant when the mother finally passed on. The daughter found herself almost at the end of her own life, with very little possibility of ever living a life of her own. Here was a great problem. Here was a case where a bad situation became tragic in a loss, because in that loss, everything was gone. The situation itself was bad from the very beginning, and there's probably no law in nature more wise than that which finally does apply the principle of the death rate to break up situations that might never otherwise be corrected. And here's this person now facing life, facing it very unfit for life. And yet, basically, a wonderful person, as a self-sacrificing individual like that must be. It's very idealistic, but not integrated. No clear vision of how to stand on her own feet. Obviously, under the situation, she wouldn't have had much opportunity. But here is a decision. Here is something that can be to her a tragedy that will end in her own death in a few years, or it can be the liberation of her life into at least a few years of self-expression in which she will have the right to begin to exercise her own individuality, which nature wants her to do. And so she has to move on into a personal existence with new motives and not depend upon the smothering motive of her own affection for the full expression of her life. These conditions arise. To her, for the moment, this passing of her mother is the greatest tragedy that could have possibly happened, although she knew in herself that it probably would have to happen. The chances are that she would survive her mother. But when it did come, it was a terrible disaster because there was no equipment for it. If this decision has to be made to build a life, to go on, to create, to be an individual at last, and to recognize that under this tragedy was the first liberation she had ever known, but she did not want to be liberated. So she has to learn this lesson, and she has to prepare for it. Otherwise, she will set more causes in motion which will produce bondage again. She has to learn. And she should have learned much earlier. And her mother and herself would both have been happier had she learned earlier. But she did not. But under duty and under the pressure of her own sense of values, she lost her own life, actually. Nature considers all these intricate situations, and out of them will come good and bad. Her devotion and her integrity are causes that will produce great good effects. Her lack of understanding and wisdom in permitting a major purpose of life to be thwarted will also probably produce lessons that she will have to face. She will have to learn the importance of not becoming completely overwhelmed by anyone else. These lessons nature will bring to her in the due course of time. But in the meantime, these crises arise and they have to be faced with some form of understanding. In her case, she had enough understanding to begin to gradually come out of it. She had some concepts of philosophy and principles, and on these rather slender resources, she is beginning to build. But without these resources, she could never have built. Had she been a materialist, she would have been completely lost. Psychologically, therefore, there is this tremendous need for the resources inside upon which to build the future. And all these resources center on law. Our only hope is in law, the value and fact of things. We have to believe that what we earn, we will get. If we do not have this belief, we have nothing left to work for or nothing left to work with. If we are in a world of accidents, then nothing is meaningful, and only blind chance can guide us through the maze of circumstances. But if we are in a world which is a lawful universe, then this law applies to us. It applies right into our own psychic integration. And here it works continuously. And the belief in it also works. And once this belief has been set within our subconscious, it continues to play its part in drawing us into a pattern of reasonable conduct. If you want, therefore, to experience some type of integration, it is always best to hunt for the law in the thing that happens. Instead of reacting, seek, search. Do the same thing with every problem that you might if you were a criminal investigator looking for motives, seeking to solve the mystery of a crime in the best Earl Stanley Gardner manner. Everything that happens is a little plot of some kind. It is a challenge. Our own lives are the greatest mystery stories ever written. And in each one of them, there are chains of clues, which if we rightly read them, if we use the wonderful inductive method described in the writings of Sherlock Holmes, we will find that there is a law, a plan, a reason, and a pattern behind every single thing that can happen. Even the most confused thing is actually completely orderly, because the confusion is the effect of confusion, and that is order. If confusion led to order, there'd be no order in the universe. But things must be like their own causes. So confusion bears witness to confusion, and this is law. To find this law in the thoughtless child, to find this law in the wayward family, not easy. But if we do not find this law for our own protection and our own guidance and our own guardianship, we cannot face these dilemmas. Oh, yes, we'll survive them somehow, but we'll survive them with alcohol, or we'll survive them with ulcers, or with mental breakdowns, or with broken homes. And these survivals are not by any means the best. To survive them with dignity that is truly proper to a human creature, we must inwardly work from a pattern of principles. These laws have to be sought out and found. And one, of course, of the most simple explains and explanations of all law is that two wrongs will never make a right. Therefore, any reaction that is wrong to an action that is wrong makes two wrongs. This is hard because we feel that a wrong action justifies another of a similar kind. Yet, as we learn from the Beatitudes, this is not the way Jesus taught it. He taught us not to return evil for evil, but to return good for evil. We can't always do it. How many persons really, honestly, can return good for evil with a full heart? Very few. They may make a kind of a mental exercise out of it. They do it in the sense of duty sometimes, from a sense of self-centeredness in others. They think there's a great dignity in suffering thus virtuously. But from a real, honest motive, because in our hearts we are really sorry for the person who does evil, because we know what they are doing to themselves, and therefore our first thought is to save them or help them, not to be angry with them. Can we do it? Yet if we cannot do it, we cannot keep the law. If we return evil for evil, we simply now set in motion another chain of circumstances that will bring a new evil to us. Because this new cause is an evil plant, a weed, a poisonous or noxious plant, which we have sowed in the earth of our own psyche. Someday that one will grow and poison us again. We cannot escape the result. We cannot in any way block off the effect. So if we are in this emergency, then we cannot afford to permit this second evil to come. Someone has hurt our affections. We break up a home. Our first thought is to strip the other person of everything we can because we hate them. We do everything possible to try to make certain that they'll never be happy again. And what is the end? Thousands of people wandering around with this money they've taken from someone else. And these people that have the money and have justified and fully enjoyed their grudges are the most miserable lot of human beings you'll ever want to meet. I've had to work with a great many of them. Their vengeance brought nothing but misery. For a little sense of offended pride, they compounded a felony. And wherever we do it, nature steps in and says, "You're going to learn that that is not the answer. And there's nothing we can do about it." The individual who cheats, who deceives, who shirks his responsibilities, is setting in motion causes that he will have to live with. Just as surely as the parent who has no time for the child develops a child that has no time for the parent. These things are inevitable. And we cannot afford to be unmindful. Every day something happens where we must think of all of this. But we don't have to sit down and rationalize and philosophize for 2 hours over everything that comes along. The point is for us to gradually, instinctively get into our consciousness that the law of cause and effect operates. and that whenever the emergency arises, we must act in the long-range concept of that law, so that at the end of any situation that arises affecting us, we can say honestly, I have done no cruel, unkind, or unreasonable thing. I have perpetuated no evil. If we can say that, we have a very good chance of our own personal lives taking on new and important meaning. One problem we have all the time is fixations of this nature. People have a grievance. Something has gone wrong. From that time on, they will never forget that incident. And that area of life is blocked for them for the rest of their days, simply because they can never get over the area in which the injury occurred. This just simply impoverishes a life. It's a wonderful thing to forget anything that causes us to take too firm an attitude against any normal and reasonable procedure. The individual who has had a poor marriage swears never to marry again. Now, perhaps the difficulty was entirely their own fault, but perhaps they've learned something. Perhaps they may find someone else who's learned something. You cannot say that the fact that a marriage has been bad, that these two people should settle down for the rest of their lives, resolving never again to have faith in any member of the opposite sex. This is just an attitude that thousands of people stew in. But they're cutting themselves off from necessary experience, because nature says it's better to have a bad time than no time. It's better to have difficulty than do nothing, because difficulty always gives you an opportunity to solve something. Difficulty is an opportunity to grow. To do nothing is to be neither hot nor cold, and the good book said, "The Lord speweth these out of his mouth." Oh, there are some very trite statements in the good book. And we don't want to be in that condition. So we have to do something. And if we cut off our attitudes or our areas of interest with some dramatic mental block, we're again setting a cause in motion that is going to produce an effect we will not want to live with. So psychologically, we are all trying to build a future that is better than the past. Or if there were good things in the past that we lost from one reason or another, we hope to reclaim them sometime, or something similar or even better. To do this, we've got to think in terms of law operating, that if we cause these things, we will get them, and that we cause them by opening ourselves generously to experience and at the same time developing the character which will permit us to handle experience and handle it constructively. As the negative factors of bad handling evaporate or disappear, health will be better, life will be more successful, and the future will be more rich in fulfillments rather than in frustrations. Wherever we fail, we suffer to some degree. And we must fail if our causes are wrong. Therefore, we are bound to be ultimately disillusioned in that which is not true. In the main point, then, in our remembrance of the law, is that the formulas of psychological therapy are not like bottled medicines. We do not solve the mental sicknesses of people with formulas. We do not say that we can give them some kind of a psychological pill that will enable them to violate the law of cause and effect. The physician and the patient must work with the law. The patient must be taught to know that the physician perhaps can assist him in an emergency, but nobody but the individual himself can conquer his own temperament. That if he does not make these adjustments, if he does not begin to set better causations in motion, no scientific skill in the world can keep him healthy or happy. He gets out of one complex and falls into another. He must correct the cause. And what we all want to do every day, as much as we can, is set up the causation of a beautiful, constructive, valuable life. And we do this only to the degree that we are able to practice beautiful, constructive, and valuable policies and keep constructive attitudes perpetually operating in our conduct. If we do this, we have a right to believe that the law will protect us. And thousands of years of history and hundreds of millions of human experiences have proven that this is true. That if we follow and obey the rules of nature in mental and emotional conduct, as in physical, we shall enjoy the peace and the tranquility and the poise and the friendliness which obedience brings. For in keeping the rules, we make ourselves the best kind of people that it is possible for us to be. Well, time's up, folks, and thank you very much. Oh, I have an announcement I have to make. Pardon me. Don't let me get out of here without making it, and don't you get out of here until I have made it, or I'll be in trouble. We mentioned last Sunday that the Goodwill Industries was having an exhibition.